All right. Sorry, I am Megan, just getting one of our guests to get on the air. Nancy, are you there? Can you hear us?
I am here.
Great.
I am here. Thank you for inviting me to be a part of the conversation.
Excellent. So I am on the phone with Nancy Marie Mithlow, and she's an associate professor of art history and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You're in Santa Fe, though, aren't you, Nancy?
I am. I teach online. It's
a
wonderful
thing.
Oh, wonderful
great.
World.
Well, she was in the TEDx Women event with me last December, and her 2009 book, Our Indian Princess Subverting the Stereotype, was published by the School for Advanced Research Press. And Nancy looks at a lot of the stereotypes of especially Indian women in popular culture and how they are co-opted. And she is one of five guests I have. The others are in the studio, and we're here to talk about an amazing new show at 516 Arts that is opening next Saturday. It's actually two shows in a way. We have on the bottom, it's Airland Seed, and on the top floor, Octopus Dreams. So we have two curators and three curators with Nancy and an artist and the executive director of 516 Arts, Suzanne Sparge. And I will make sure all their mics are up so you can hear them. Hello, ladies. Thanks for joining us today on Women's Focus here on KUNM.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to start with Beverly and Suzanne and have you talk a little bit about the show that you curated, Octopus Dreams, which is part of the same, all of one show, but it's on the second floor. Now, the point of both these shows is it's contemporary Native artists exploring displacements and cultural identity in our modern culture. So can you talk a little bit about what people will see when they go to the show, Octopus Dreams? And I'll start. She's pointing at Beverly. So go ahead, Beverly.
Hi, thank you. Octopus Dreams came to life a couple of years ago when another curator of the project, Charles Jones, invited myself to put together a collection of work to be shown in Russia. He had a couple of shows. He's a printmaker, a master printmaker, and he'd had a couple of shows. And his colleague and curator in Russia, Andrei Martinov, invited us to submit work. So we started reaching out to artists. In the meantime, another curator of the museum in Ekaterinburg requested 200 works. And at that point, we realized we needed help, so we started asking around, and we learned about Suzanne Frick. And she put the word out, and she put up a website and invited artists to submit work. And at that point, we got in touch with the Institute, Jessie Riker, and her class helped us collect the work and catalog it and inventory it and package it and send it to Russia. And that was in 2012. And we had two shows, one that opened a year ago, I think this weekend, in Ekaterinburg, and the three of us sitting here, we went there along with Linda Lomahavdua. Anyway, and the show that you'll see in at 516 Arts are the works from the Novosibirsk show that opened in September of 2012. And that show is 50 works of contemporary Native American artworks on paper.
Oh, that's fantastic. So what will people talk about the artists who are involved in the show? Where do they come from?
Well, it was very important that we bring in art from across North America. When I was brought in, this is Suzanne Frick talking. I'm a professor of art history with a PhD in Native American art history. My specialty is contemporary art. And I started to think about work on paper. Where was work on paper being made? Where was that important across Native America? And I thought about areas like the Northwest Coast. So we brought in three artists from that region, and they did the wonderful serigraphy that they do with that form line drawing, some of it very updated, some of it more historic in form. We thought about the Inuit artists, where work on paper has revolutionized their economy up in the Cape Dorset region. We were so lucky that...
Can I ask you a little bit more about that? Talk about that.
Oh, about the Cape Dorset region?
Mm-hmm. Where is that?
Well, you go north and you just keep going north. It is so far north. It's very far north. It's the top.
Beyond Siberia.
It's actually, no, it's on the Americas.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry.
I guess you could get to Siberia pretty quickly from there. This was an area where big sea animal fishing was a huge part of their economy. And as the animals have died out, as the water has become polluted, it's really challenged their way of life. In the mid-20th century, stone carving was introduced. There's a lot of natural stone there that creates beautiful small figurines that were then shipped down to galleries in Toronto and Vancouver, and it really brought a lot of much-needed income to the region. Soon after, printing on stone cut printing was introduced. What they developed there is it's a wonderful system. It's not just an individual artist going out and making images. There are communities of art makers. There are specific printers. Everyone in the community is allowed to submit drawings. So during the off season, during the time when it's too cold to be fishing, when it's too frozen, people could spend their time drawing and printing. Certain images would then be chosen, and every year they come out, every year since, I guess since the mid-1950s, they would produce an annual body of work. And they try to make it very specific. They don't want to flood the market. So every year there's only 30 to 50 prints from different communities. And these images, they're vivid in their colors. A lot of the subject matter explores mythology. It explores the world around them. They're really quite beautiful. And this has been a wonderful way to maintain life in that region, when otherwise, with the depletion of the sea mammals up there, it might have ended. And they are facing a lot of devastation from environmental sources. I think one of the saddest things I've ever heard is that women in that region are encouraged not to breastfeed. The high content of mercury in the animals that they eat can actually taint their own the breast milk, which is a very sad fact of life. Into this area, then, the introduction of art, the viability of art in that region has been a revolutionary, helpful boon.
That's so, I mean, you're talking about it sounds like a really isolated, cold region, and I'm trying to picture printmaking.
Oh,
up there.
Well, and the prints that they produce are just quite beautiful.
So they have printmaking machines.
And they do stone prints. Actually, we have a master printer here, Deborah Hobola, who can tell us about how
Deborah,
stone prints go.
You are from Isleta Pueblo. You're one of the artists in the show.
Yes, I am. And thank you, everybody, for having me here today. They are master printers out there, and they work on soapstone. They would actually carve the stone way before they got introduced to lithography, which is my forte in my printmaking expertise. I am a stone lithographer. I am a half Isleta Pueblo and half Jemez Pueblo, born and raised on the reservation. And to start to explore this venue of printmaking and the process itself was intriguing to me as an artist, and actually correlating it with working on stone as my ancestors did in petroglyphs. I kind of related it in that aspect, but as Susan has been speaking about Cape Dorset, that really fascinated as a graduate student, and I did a lot of research in that area, and Susan is quite accurate about her info on Cape Dorset. They actually teach, there was a guy named John Smith who worked out there for the government and actually taught these people different arts and crafts, and he actually learned the art of lithography and passed that down to the indigenous people out there, and they loved that process because there was nothing to do in the very cold depths of the winter. And Cape Dorset is practically in the Arctic Circle, so you know they have very, very long nights or very, very long days. And in that time, that's when the artists did their drawing and their creative process and actually taught the native indigenous people, certain people that took the interest to learn the processing of stone lithography.
Talk about your work, Deborah. What do you like to explore with your prints?
I like the surface of the stone. I'm the artist that loves the process more than the making the traditional edition of the printmaking. I love the scientific aspect of lithography, mixing my chemicals of nitric acid and gum arabic and measuring that out, hoping not to burn any of my fine detail out. So I think that becomes the most intriguing part of what excites me of this process, and also depicting the history of my people, you know, and my culture, the roles of women, and also turning these images into a surrealistic, I guess, image and a view for people to see, you know. I also like capturing the old photographs of the past of relatives or my people and their daily lives and how hard they worked. Society's not labor intense anymore. I mean, technology has really drove us back from this labor intensity. So lithography is actually a dying art because it's so much labor intense behind its process.
And Nancy, I wanted to bring you in because you're curating the show that's downstairs that's has a lot of, it's mostly printmaking, I think. Can you talk about the description you guys have for the show called Printmaking Highly Politicized? Can you talk about that?
Yes, actually there are four curators. Elisabetta Frasca, who's our Italian colleague from Rome, myself, Paul Baker Prindle, who's working with the University of Nevada, Reno, and Sarah Ann Stolte, who is a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And this is part of an initiative that we've been working on for almost two decades. This is Indigenous Arts at the Venice Biennale. This is our seventh exhibit that we've sponsored in Venice during the Biennale, and we've been very fortunate to be hosted by the University of Venice's Department of Postcolonial Literature. And so we brought nine artists, Faisal Abdullah, Emily Arthur, Marwin Begay, John Hitchcock, Ryan O'Malley, Henry Payer, Dwayne Slick, Max Stevens, and Deani Whitehawk, to Venice to present prints. And, you know, in our mind, the printmaking medium really lent itself to this politicized statement that we were interested as a collective, artists, educators, intellectuals, activists, making on that international stage. And we were commenting upon the militarization of indigenous homelands and kind of adopting and subverting, you know, that military song of the Marine Credo from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
And talk a little bit about what kinds of themes people are exploring through printmaking in Air, Land, Seed.
You know, a lot of the artists used animal icons and imagery, kind of juxtaposed with other military icons like tanks. You know, there's commentary. Marwin Begay frequently uses a skull or a skeletal figure in his works. But there's also, I think, a lot of coded imagery. And I went to an opening last night talking with another contemporary artist, America Meredith, who said something along the lines of, you know, Native artists were always kind of forced into using these codes to say the things that we want to say. And I found that to be true for our show as well.
Why is that? Can you talk about that?
Well, I think some of it is attached to the commercial market. You know, artists aren't necessarily always beholden to that market, but it is a factor that people keep in mind. And, you know, I think America still really hasn't come to grips with its colonial history. And so, you know, the messages that Native artists are interested in exploring are often stories that, A, you know, the public doesn't know about. They wouldn't even really understand the people, the places, the history involved. And, B, they really, you know, don't want to be, I think, faced with their complicity in those histories.
Okay. I wanted to go back to Suzanne. I cut you off because I got so intrigued by the Cape Dorset.
That's right. I did want to finish the tour, which is that paper was also very important among the Plains tribes, that the ledger drawing tradition. And that's something that came out wonderfully in the show that will be in Octopus Dreams. Artists like Lynn Allen, Chris Pappen, they use that format, that ledger drawing
what
format.
What was ledger drawing?
Well, they would take old ledgers that those were used for accounting. So they often have figures, numbers on it that do the whole writing down what things cost, who's bought what, and they would just draw right over it, often on top of the numbers, and you get these incredible stories that have been preserved in the drawings. This started in the mid-1860s. It became a much more practiced art in the 1870s, 1880s. These drawings are highly prized these days. There's a lot of wonderful work that was done there. You see in the work of Lynn Allen that she sort of layers in these drawings. And an artist like Chris Pappen, who will create a portrait and layer it on top digitally, using the digital media to create a brand new style of ledger drawing. And there's something wonderfully archival about it, that he's not actually using old paper and using it up. It's something he can use the image and reuse it. He can alter the image. Sometimes he'll repeat figures. Wonderful way of using digital imagery. And sometimes the ledger drawings, they have figures, they have horses, teepees. And that's something you see in the work of Deborah Yipa-Pappen, her wonderful Hello Kitty teepee, which I'm not surprised was chosen as on the cover of the advertisement. It's the colors in it are so exaggerated and saturated. The figures have been layered. There's this wonderful playing of fiction and history. And Hello Kitty shows up on one of the teepees. She really plays with identity.
Yeah, talk about, what do you think, it's always, I guess, you know, there could be a million interpretations, but what are you reading from that that's intriguing, that you put a traditional Plains image with the teepee and then Hello Kitty?
Well, she is definitely playing with the tropes of Native identity, the teepee being something immediately identifiable, although she is half Korean, half Hamez, and she often deals with her dual heritage in her art, so she layers the images to suggest the layering in the worldview that she grew up in, and I think maybe even Hello Kitty might have a personal message. She does. I know she has a daughter, and even the purple hair that she gives herself in the drawing. I have seen the occasional image of her with a little bit of color in her hair. So there is a spirit of fun, but there is something very serious about the message as well.
Beverly, you have a background in film and digital media, and I saw in your bio. Is that my correct?
Yes,
in that?
That's.
And does this enter into the show? I've heard a little bit people mixing sort of traditional printmaking and digital media. Is that, will we see more of that?
I think we have an artist that will have Chase Banks will have digital media. As myself, as a filmmaker, I had hoped to document the whole this whole process, but that was, you know, that was another job. It was a full-time job to, yeah, I think, bring the show to Russia and then back.
And talk about, are there also in the show, in terms of the Russian connection, representations or artists from indigenous groups in that area? I confess I don't know a lot about some of the indigenous groups that may or may not still be in Russia.
Unfortunately, there weren't any in this show. I think Suzanne and I and Andre are talking about doing a dual show with indigenous Russian people and Native American people. But I think the people in Russia were intrigued and still are by the artwork. First, you know, again, to realize that Native American artists are alive and well, creating contemporary work that you know, has an impact. And there's still a vibrant indigenous culture in Russia as well. So, I think Siberia is kind of, you know, is kind of the Wild West of, you know, Eastern Russia. So there's a lot of similarities in the personalities and the experiences of indigenous people.
I just wanted to mention that you talk to Russians, and one of the most popular film series developed in the 1960s and 70s came out of Red Chief Soviet films. It's a series of Westerns, guys with
really?
The big mustachios and people riding on horses, and it really looked like it was filmed in New Mexico. And I said, when did they come to the U.S.? And like, we just went out to the steppes and filmed it. And so that was one of their favorite subjects. Indians, cowboys, shootouts, saloons.
And it's true in Germany,
girls.
Too. That's why I was wondering how they're reacting to these are very contemporary Native visions here. Well, it's not those stereotypes, right? Or they're playing with those stereotypes.
It's true, but I think they really embraced it. In fact, the show that went to Yekaterinburg won that city's Grand Prix as the best museum show of 2012. We won 50,000 rubles for the museum, which was exciting.
Oh, that's great. And Deborah, talk about some of the stuff you'll have in the show, or if you have one piece or more than one.
I'm going to have three pieces in the show, and these are pieces that were in somewhere in Yekaterinburg Museum and in Siberia. They were all lithographs. They are different processes of lithographs. Some are toner washes. Some are direct drawings on stone with a dusting process of dry powder pigment. And there is a new series that I put out with my thunder beans, which are a mythological bean that brings us rain and that we believe live in the earth and will hopefully, when bring thunder, will correct people and put them back on their feet. But what I wanted to say with the dialogue we're talking about with the reaction to the Russians and the Native American artists that were presented there, they were just so fascinated. They were looking at our skin. As soon as we walked down the street, they knew we were of a different culture, of a different country.
Did they think you were from Central Asia?
Yeah, actually, they even thought I was from Hawaii. So it was a good response, but everybody was so kind and so generous. The Russian people are very generous and so interested in who we are as Native people. They were still asking, do you live in teepees? Of course, that generic question they ask us, are we still riding horses? Do we all live together? You know, they were unaware of how many different tribes and the various tradition of our tribes within the United States and abroad, you know. And so it was really interesting to have that fantasy of these people and this interest and these questions. The opening of the show made all of us rock stars and signing autographs left and right, and we were sweating and we couldn't even drink our first glass of wine to cheer. We were just so bombarded with questions and people wanting to know who we are, what we're doing, how can they come to the U.S. and find us. This fascination was so intriguing for all of us. We were just astonished by it all.
Do you think that you need to go abroad to find that?
I think so. I think
why
we
is
need...
that?
Because there's so much to see and so much to share. Culture is so deep in the earth, and there's still so many people that have beliefs and customs to share, and traditions and languages, and so much to learn from each other, because we are bridging in so many ways. That makes it more fascinating to me as a Native person and an artist. They shared, they brought us gifts, they gave us presents. I mean, it was like we were royalty to them. It was, you know, it was an experience of a lifetime I will never, ever forget in my life.
Nancy, I wanted to ask you, I don't know, I'm just thinking about some of the work you've done as I'm listening to Deborah. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I was wondering what... I don't know if Native artists get that kind of recognition in the U.S.
You know, when we started the nonprofit to go to Venice in 1999, the impetus was that under the Venice Biennale Forum, there's national representations and there are national pavilions, kind of like an old World Fair format. And we realized that Native people, you know, were, of course, not included in that, sadly. You know, the American Pavilion does not represent us, even though the Canadian Pavilion and the Australian Pavilion, New Zealand, they've all brought Indigenous artists to that platform. So that was our aim, was just to be able to make a space for Native artists to create whatever they wanted to in that global stage. And like Deborah was saying, it can be really transformative for the participants. You know, when they go, they're being able to see their work in light of works that are considered the best in the world. And they can both see, oh, wow, my work actually matches up or exceeds on some levels. Or they could actually draw from either methods, materials, presentation styles, and it will enhance their work. So over time, what our group has really prided itself on is that those individuals go back to their communities, and then they're able to make contributions there in their communities from that experience that they had overseas. And that's, again, even, you know, equally valuable, and it enhances their own craft.
And what we'll see at 516, is this the full version of what you all had at the Biennale, or is it a smaller part of what you took to the Biennale?
It's in a large part, represents what was shown in Venice, but also our artists will be producing live printmaking there throughout the week. And maybe Sven Sparge can speak to the activities planned for 516 Arts, but there will be the opportunity for folks to drop by, meet with the artists, create prints themselves. In Venice, people were bringing T-shirts, shoes. Well, Faisal Abdullah was cutting hair as part of a performance. Sadly, he won't be part of
the can we do that
endeavor.
Oh, I want to do that here.
but we will be doing live printmaking, so maybe Suzanne could tell you more about our schedule.
We will talk about that in just a minute. I have to play a quick message, and then I'm going to play a CD, and then we will be back. This is Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with the curators and artists of a new show opening next Saturday in Albuquerque at 516 Arts, Airland Seed, and then a companion show, Octopus Dreams. And that was Pura Fe, and she was born in New York, now based out of North Carolina, and has descendants from the Tuscarora Nation. And I am here on Women's Focus with curators and artists from the new show at 516 Arts called Airland Seed and Octopus Dreams. And it's a showcase of contemporary Native artists exploring themes around home and alienation and a reappropriation. And not only will there be the exhibit that opens on Saturday, June 29th, but also a number of events. And I wanted to ask Suzanne Sparge, who's the executive director at 516. Could you talk a little bit about those, Suzanne?
Sure. Thanks for having us here today, Megan. We have many events happening the day of the opening, and also this week leading up to the opening. We have a residency program sponsored by the Visual Artists Network that's allowing us to bring Emily Arthur and John Hitchcock to do community events as part of the Airland Seed exhibition. So they'll be doing a project called Impact versus Influence, and it consists of banners, flags, and giveaways. So Tuesday through Thursday afternoon at 516 from 12 to 5, the public is invited to join the artists in the printing of a large-scale, like 10 by 30-foot banner, which will then be part of a parade of flags outdoors on Saturday. So people can come and just observe or actually participate in printmaking with the artists. And then on Saturday morning, it's June 29th, at 9 a.m., they'll be leading a print blitz, which is basically a hands-on printmaking action where they'll be printing on T-shirts and fabric and flags and giving prints away, and everyone's invited to bring shirts that they'll print on, and then that'll culminate.
And that's at the Downtown Growers Market?
Yes, okay. Sorry about that. It's at the Growers Market at Robinson Park, which is 8th Street and Central. So bring T-shirts and come out for that. And then
is there anything they won't print on?
I don't know. But then at 11, they'll have a parade of flags, which will include the large banner that they've been working all week, and lots of other flags that they've created here as well as from other projects. And they'll be doing that around the Growers Market, and so everyone's invited. And then at 4 p.m. at 516 Arts, we have a public forum that's called Indigenous Artists in Global Contexts, and that features artists and curators from both exhibitions, Airland Seed and Octopus Dreams, who will talk about printmaking as a political intervention, the diasporic experience, Native sovereignty, and how Indigenous art has been received and interpreted by international audiences. So that's going to be a great conversation. There's 9 people on the panel, and it'll really be a discussion with the public as well. And Nancy Marie Maitlow, who you've been hearing, she'll be leading that discussion. And lastly, the big party in the evening is the opening reception from 6 to 8 p.m. for both shows. And everyone's invited to come celebrate. We'll have live music with guitar maestro Ramon Bermudez Jr. And we will also have food from local restaurants, and it'll be a celebration. So I hope everyone will join us.
That's great. That's at 516 Arts in downtown Albuquerque, 516 Central Southwest?
Yes, Southwest between 5th and 6th. Our website is 516arts.org, and our phone number is 242-1445.
And I wanted to go to Suzanne. What is Octopus Dreams? What is that title?
The title comes from the novel The Ancient Child by N. Scott Momaday, who is one of the artists in the show. And he was talking about a dream that an artist had. He had a dream that he was wandering by the sea, and he saw an octopus half dying on the beach, and he carried it back to the ocean and saved its life. And in his musings, he said, "I wonder if, in the dark night of the sea, the octopus dreams of me." I always loved that quick way in which he so deftly changed the perspective from a man looking at an octopus to an octopus looking at a man, and the ways in which so much of the way we perceive of the world has to do with our perception, our point of view. So the title was designed to reflect what we were trying to do in the show, which was to show the depth of talent, the range of styles and topics, subject matter, emotions that you can find in contemporary Native art. There is no monolithic Native art today, nor has there ever been. And if you look at this show, it's just a small sampling, but you get such a range. You have the beautiful history displayed in the work of Linda Lamahaftoa, her Moundville. She was inspired by a trip that she took looking at ancient mounds, mound sites. She is Hopi and Choctaw, so she was examining her you know, aspects of her tribal past. You also see that in the work of Deborah Hohola. You see in the contemporary work of Lynn Allen, her photographs, where she has isolated images like a spur or a moccasin, and this decontextualization and explores the ethnographic view that too often takes place from non-Native to Native cultures. The work of America Meredith, where she worked in a technique known as fumage. She creates, she uses a serigraphy, a stencil, and she imprints paper using smoke. And smoke is such an important aspect of the Cherokee Nation, where she's from. The idea of smoking a peace pipe, the idea of sharing tobacco, smoke as a means for sharing prayers. There's just such a huge range. And I think, I hope that this show, that when people look at it and they come away, they'll just enjoy the depth of it. Enjoy the variety.
You want to add anything, Beverly?
Thank you, Suzanne. I think she said it very eloquently.
I wanted to ask Nancy, just going back for a moment to the panel, what kinds of things do you anticipate exploring with the, we have 9 people? Boy, that's a large panel. I hope you're a good moderator.
Well, hopefully it'll just be a conversation amongst peers about our experiences overseas and, you know, really trying to create a dialogue about indigeneity globally. What does that represent and how can that be enhanced? What kind of vocabularies are we using to describe these experiences and where do we think it's going to lead?
That's great. And I wanted to go back to something you said, Suzanne, when you were talking about the description of Momaday's poem, and then also, oh, now I'm going to forget. You were talking about
perspective. Flipping.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I was going to ask you in the context of indigenous perspective versus, because I see you've done some work around possession and Native American art, and I guess I'm trying to get at, what am I trying to get at here? I'm trying to get at kind of the post-colonial dynamic that might be explored in some of these works, or who creates art, who owns art.
And that is such a complex question when dealing with Native art, in that the idea of who is it being made for, who is going to buy it, how is a Native artist going to support him, herself as an artist? What audience are they going to use? And you heard earlier, Nancy, talking about the encoding, the idea of having to encode messages. And the work of Emmy Whitehorse really encapsulates that idea, that her work, it's beautifully abstract. It's so gorgeous in the colors that she chooses. And at first, it can seem entirely abstract, but as you look at it, she's often exploring the idea of landscape and the idea of heritage. But she can't talk about it directly, that would be too revealing, and it would not be understood in the dual context that she has to work in, that her the Diné context as well as the non-Native. So she finds this way to articulate ideas through abstraction.
That's interesting. Wow.
As Suzanne's talking, what I'm thinking about, I'm musing on, is that it's both, I think, the icons and the visual things that we're seeing in terms of content, but also process. So I really appreciated Deborah talking about the connection to petroglyphs and pictographs and the work that she does. Some of the artists in Airland Seed actually started using new materials. Emily Arthur's piece that got profiled for some of the press for 516, it's a water moccasin with shot. She's actually used a gun to shoot through the paper, and it ties into a childhood story of her mother shooting a water moccasin. Ryan O'Malley is using gunpowder in one of his buffalo head pieces. So I think it's really exciting to again open up this conversation about what is contemporary Indigenous arts and how the artists are approaching these issues.
I'm interested, Deborah, what the market is like for an artist like you working in a contemporary medium, contemporary themes, hearkening back to traditional themes, but I don't know, someone coming from, I don't know, New Jersey who wants to come to New Mexico, like, well, that's not what I thought Native American art was.
Yeah, it's well, I can only speak for myself. It is a very tough market to be an artist, especially now with the economy bad. In the 80s, it was fantastic. I mean, you could make a living being an artist. Now I hold like two other jobs besides being an artist. And it's, you know, it's hard to depict what's going to sell and what's not. And I don't choose to work that way as an artist. I choose, I guess, kind of like the values of my beliefs and the strength and the power of my people, you know. And if not everybody, and also what's important to me is to also know my boundaries. Just exactly what Susan was explaining with Emily.
Emmy Whitehorse.
Yeah, Emmy Whitehorse, excuse me. I just lost that thought for a minute. But yes, you know, like, we do have boundaries set within our tribe and our culture. So how much of that can we exploit as an artist and as individuals that come from such a strong culture that still carries strong beliefs and spirituality? So I usually base my work, and I just really let it go. But at the same time, I have to know my boundaries, and I don't do it for the public. I just have this, I guess, insight or this imagination or this vision. I really don't know. But if I see something or I have witnessed and maybe a something on the news, something concurrent with our daily lives, and I incorporate that, you know, either making it abstract or making it surreal or making it exactly what it is. I think it's hard to explain exactly what direction sometimes a artist goes into or what exactly sells and does not sell in the market world has been a big issue, because some people like certain things, and it's hard to judge what people will buy at the Santa Fe Indie Market, at the Heard Museum, you know, all these market venues that artists go to make a living off their work. It's affect us all, the economy, and it's really a tough career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
Megan, if I could just jump in for a minute, because I think that the commercial aspect is one dimension of Native arts making and a very important dimension that shouldn't be dismissed. But I think Native professionals as artists are also entering other fields. And the majority of the artists that are being featured on Airland Seed are university professors.
Okay.
You know, so they're making their living by teaching the next generation. But they're also, you know, known as a professional artist. So, you know, I like to kind of expand that shift on the commercial aspect, because I know that our artists are fulfilling roles across the spectrum of professionals available to them.
And I'm guessing, Nancy, this gives them perhaps a little more leeway to explore things that are not necessarily commercially successful and explore these ideas and permutations of themes that they want to look at in the show,
well,
right?
You know, I think the Native artist role is really unique from what we think of as a Western artist role, you know, and that's something that I do explore a lot in my scholarship, and the other folks on the panel there can talk more about that. But, you know, I think it's more holistic, perhaps, and that there's a whole service component to communities that's unique as well, less individualistic.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. Well, you will have to go see for yourself because we're out of time. Do you have any final words or that I should add in? You had wonderful thoughts. So.
Thanks. Speaking for myself, I could talk about these issues for days. And I think that one wonderful aspect that 516 Arts has added to bringing these two shows together, these two shows that come from a global context coming together, is it does add another layer of richness, this idea of a global audience.
Very good. Well, the show is Airland Seed and also Octopus Dreams. They're both going to be at 516 Arts in Albuquerque, opening June 29th. And you can find out more at 516arts.org. You can see the schedule for all the things taking place this week, because before the opening, of course, as Suzanne was saying, we have these great activities that you can get involved in, actual hands-on printmaking and creation. And I wanted to thank you all for coming here on Women's Focus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.